Hi, I'm Reverend Carol Saunders, host of the Spiritual Forum. I'm here with a lot of interesting people who are consciously walking the spiritual path, experiencing and expressing the divine in unique ways and through unique lenses. Everyone here has wisdom to share and an interesting story to tell, all to inspire you on your spiritual path. Welcome to the Forum. Welcome to the Spiritual Forum, everyone. I'm so glad you're here. It's a beautiful day in Wisconsin. We're actually having a very early spring, and thus I have short sleeves, and I'm pretending that it's springtime. And our geese have come back to our pond, so it's like, wow, Mother Nature's starting early this year. I want to send a shout out to Stephanie for contributing to the Spiritual Forum podcast, Prayer and Retreat Ministry. This is 100% donation-based ministry, and I appreciate anything that anybody sends because it keeps it going and also keeps you in the flow of giving and receiving. So appreciate everything, small, large, anything in between. Just thank you for considering that you're benefiting from this and giving back. I also want to say, if you're watching on YouTube, to press that subscribe button if you haven't yet. I want to encourage you to do that. I'm getting close to a big milestone, and as soon as we hit that, we can all celebrate together, and I just really appreciate everyone who's joining me there. Also, my long-term audio audience, I've been doing this for, I don't know, 5 years or so, and many of you have been with me from the beginning, so I want to thank you all for that. Let me introduce you to my guest today, Michael Hutchinson. He's a retired scientist with a parallel involvement in an ancient yoga tradition that emphasizes working with the breath. He has 40 years of experience within this tradition and studied with its founder, whose name is TKV Desikachar. I got that. This places him as a leading teacher of remedial breathwork. Now, Michael's recently written a book called Breath for Health, and it's a concise handbook on how to improve your breathing based on centuries-old understanding of the breath-mind-body relationship and backed by current medical research. And Michael comes to us today from Hampshire, United Kingdom. Welcome, yes. Michael.
And thank you very much, Carol, for hosting me on this show. I'm always delighted to speak about yoga, breathing, and I think you've asked me to speak about the potential spiritual aspect of the teaching and experience that I have working with my breath. And so actually, this is my first opportunity really to share this on any channel of this nature. And so this is an adventure for me. Thank you very much.
Oh, that's wonderful. I think it's so interesting when people have a scientific background and they find themselves deeply embedded in the spiritual. And for me, there's really no difference. I've heard a lot of people think they're completely separate entities or separate structures of thinking and experience. But to me, there's not just intersection, they're kind of the same thing going at it from different points of view. And so why don't you tell us a little bit about your spiritual journey and how you've integrated the science and the yoga and how you've kind of gotten to helping people with breath and yoga.
It's a strange thing, but when I was young, I rejected the idea of God or spirituality. And in fact, when I was a student at the University of Cambridge, I was actually secretary of the Humanist Society. I was so committed to atheism at that time. And I continued my links with that. And a couple of years later, I went to a conference in Oxford, now expecting some inspiring talks from now leading atheists. And I was shocked. I realized that in the way that they were criticizing, particularly the Christian faith, these speakers seemed just as bigoted as the people that they were criticizing. So I wasn't the only one who felt this, and we just sort of got out and went and sat under a mulberry tree and just chatted amongst ourselves. And gradually, Carol, I came to become more open-minded and to consider, you know, how meditation, for example, might change my life and change my attitudes, as I realized that of all this was the fact that, you know, my attitudes and relationships to other people, my attitude to life in general, really needed a big remake. And so this is what really started me on this journey, which eventually I came to yoga because I found that certainly the people I came into contact with, the teachers I came into contact with, were prepared to consider the role of people's feelings, emotions, hang-ups, if you like, as part of their journey, and no, not something to be brushed aside. How I came to have a belief in something beyond, or someone beyond this material world, I cannot really tell you. I just think that it kind of developed and eventually blossomed inside me just by sticking to my practice, by continuing to study with Mr. Desikachol, and to, you know, start asking myself questions like, for example, what is consciousness? And how are we to explain consciousness? There are scientists, neuroscientists at work now trying to explain consciousness as something that arises from, you know, the neurological functioning in the brain. And I thought, well, okay, I accept that what I think I'm seeing is actually a picture provided to me by something going on in here. But who is watching that picture? And we've reached the conclusion, it's reached many years ago in India, that the ultimate observer cannot be part of what we observe, that there must be some kind of immanent spirit that resides within conscious beings that makes us into experiences of the world. And that inner experiencer is not part of the material world, is someone else. And it's really an extension of that to think that, well, are we all separate, disconnected experiences? Or are we all connected in some way? Are we all connected and potentially connected with someone who is not part of this world at all, never been actually part of this world? And sort of that conclusion meant that some of the things that I could read, for example, in the Gospels or in Bhagavad Gita, which are both really about personal salvation, how those teachings started to make sense and things started to fall into place. And so now I can look into these different texts. Maybe there are others I haven't looked into, and sort of feel that, you know, I'm part of a community stretching across time, across space, across different faiths, a community who understand that there is something, someone beyond this material world.
That's really very interesting. You certainly asked, you know, really deep questions where most people stop. And I think your story about the atheists is really interesting. You know, I went through my own time of being atheist. I went through atheist, agnosticism, and rejecting all of that, rejecting God, rejecting the Bible. And I realized, at least for me, I hadn't asked the deeper questions. I just was really projecting blame onto these religions and these beliefs. But I also feel similarly. It's like, how did I come to experiencing the divine? It's an experience. It's not anything I can really write down and put into words. I think you put it into words pretty darn well, looking beyond the material and knowing that there's something else. And that's just really fascinating to me that you went beyond that explanation that the brain is what creates consciousness, because I think that's what the materialists think. The brain is the creator of consciousness. So anyway, you pursued yoga as did I get this right? Did you pursued yoga as a result of the experience of there's something beyond this, or the experience of yoga gave you the experience of that there's something beyond the material?
In my studies with Mr. Desikachar and his close associates, these sort of questions came up. It was interesting. Mr. Desikachar felt that he had a responsibility to share with us these teachings, which he'd acquired from his father. His father, Krishnamacharya, is considered by many to be the father of modern yoga. Most people, when they think about yoga, they think about postures, they might think about breathing, they might think about meditation. Desikachar's father, Krishnamacharya, was a seeker after God. He was a really devout Hindu, what they call a Vaishnava. And I think that what I've been doing is I've been picking up here and there some bits of Krishnamacharya's teaching that have leaked through to me. And now to really sympathize and empathize with his search for God. But the experience of being in contact with the divine, or at least being in contact with the peace which I think resides at the bottom of everyone's heart, though they know it or not, I mean, this is the step on the way, and this is where I think some ways of working with the breath can help people, because there's always been this connection between the breath and the spiritual.
Yeah, it's interesting. In the Judeo-Christian tradition, the breath is mentioned a lot in the Bible. I actually looked it up before I got here, and the one scripture I thought was really interesting was Isaiah chapter 42:5, but there's many, many of them. And it says, "Thus says God, the Lord, who created the heavens and stretched them out, who spread out the earth and its offspring, who gives breath to the people on it and spirit to those who walk in it." There's just a lot of references to the breath of God, and that our life being sustained by breath and connected to the divine by breath and connected to each other by breath. It's really just such a miracle.
It is a miracle indeed, Carol, that every breath that we take is, in a sense, an opportunity to connect with something deep within our hearts. Most of the time, the breath is simply functional, just keeping this body moving, energized, alive. There are ways which I've unconsciously worked on. I was given what's called a pranayama practice, working with my breath in a structured way, by my then teacher nearly, 35 to 40 years ago. And so every night when I came home from work, you know, I would help to get the dinner started, and then 15 minutes I would go away quietly and do this practice. And little did I know at the time that I started it that how this would connect me with some ideas that are kind of buried in the yoga teachings and needed to be brought out and were possibly assumed or expected to be part of the sort of way that the yoga teachers were handed down generations by word of mouth. And some of these yoga texts are basically just a word to the wise. And if you don't know what they're about, you don't understand them. They make no sense. I suppose you could say they're not intentionally cryptic. It's just to communicate something over generations by word of mouth, no paper. Things need to be brief. And so yoga, what we have of it, is like a jigsaw puzzle where there are lots of pieces missing. And so it's the responsibility of those of us around the world who are trying to understand and trying to practice some of these things to now discover the shape and size and color of those pieces that are missing.
How would you define yoga if someone just asked you what is yoga and they knew nothing about it? How would you define it?
My definition would very much depend, Carol, on whom I was addressing. So to someone, you know, a care seeker coming to me for help with a back problem, I would say that yoga is about reaching a state of absence of pain through working with breath and movement. And one definition of yoga is to reach a point that one hasn't reached before. So that would be a relevant definition. Okay. To someone coming from your direction, I would say that yoga is about union with God. I'm very conscious about when people come to us for teaching, come to us for help, first thing to do is to find out, where is that person coming from? What is their need? What is their aspiration? And so now if someone comes to me with a back problem and I say yoga is about getting in touch with God, I say, who is this guy? I'm going somewhere else.
Yeah, I get that. But it's all of it. And I think that's so wonderful. It's all of it. And it's because of the whole mind, body, spirit interconnection. So I can definitely see how you have to adjust your answer to where people are.
Exactly.
So let's move a little bit to the breath, because that's the focus of your book. And I've been thinking a lot about breath. I have a new grandbaby, and I can watch her breathe. She knows how to breathe. And somewhere along the line, we forget how to breathe. So I'm really interested in the breath. Mm-hmm. For somebody who doesn't know anything, what is the right way to breathe? And why do we lose our capacity for breathing the way we did when we started off as infants?
As you know, there are two main aspects to breathing in and breathing out. And there's a lot of misunderstanding as regards both aspects of breathing. So it asks me to speak about this from a spiritual point of view. And so I'm going to talk first about breathing in. Something that puzzled me for many years is why, when I ask people to breathe in, their shoulders go up. Okay, and this has puzzled me and it's puzzled many of my colleagues in the same tradition. So I was working one-to-one with someone here in this room 5-6 years ago, I forget. And I just had this inspiration. I just said to her, Jane, think about your breath coming in forward of your heart. And so having worked with me for a while, she was able to do this straight away, to follow this instruction. And once she started her breath in this way, forward of her heart, the shoulders stayed down. And she just said to me, Michael, that's magic. But there's a deeper thing here, Carol, if I may continue. There are a couple of texts that talk about not only as we breathe in, sensing the feeling that there's an opening forward of the heart as your breath starts to come in. There's also potential for a feeling that as your breath comes in, it is moving from, there's a movement from your throat to your heart, almost as if there were a channel down the inside of your breastbone. There are references to this. I think mostly they're little understood. But because of the practice that my teacher gave me all those years ago, I had the experience to relate to this straight away. And so I find that when I breathe in this way, and I remember to have this focus, then I feel more settled. I feel more peaceful. It's this settled, peaceful feeling, which I believe is just a sensing a glimmer of that peace and light, which is at the bottom of my heart. Just a glimmer. And building on that, it's possible in a very quiet space, having done some preliminary work with my breath, to at times actually contact this place, this place of peace. And this is a step on the way, really. Contact, in order to contact the presence of God in our hearts, which I believe is possible, one needs first to be absolutely at peace. And so I think that I've described for you some of the steps, and this is very much a step-by-step approach. No expectations, just do the practice, just discover for yourself. One of the mistakes that I made, or in a sense continued to make, is to have any kind of expectation. We must, being in all humility, offer ourselves up to the practice of breathing and meditation and accept whatever we experience. Only then might we, at times, be there.
So you're describing the breath as a way to really connect to the divine, and
yes,
and that so it can be used for healing and for pain relief and whatnot, yes, for those who are seeking that, and for those who are seeking God, Spirit, it is a way to experience within one's body that peace, and from that place you have the opportunity to contact or be in connection with the divine. And this whole shoulder thing is interesting. I mean, I don't know what that is. I don't know what that is, but I am aware that there's a kind of a chest cavity breathing, and there's kind of a belly breathing. And I am aware that sometimes we breathe in shallowly and exhale long, and sometimes we inhale long and exhale shallowly, and there's got to be some sort of rhythm that is good for our health and good for our spirit. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Well, first of all, I have to be honest, Carol, and say that there's a certain amount of groundwork to be done. And for someone starting from scratch, working with the breath, you know, the first few chapters of my book provide that groundwork. And it's only then in chapter four that I start to talk about, you know, describe sort of things I've described to you. And then by that time, I hope someone who's worked over weeks and months on the first three chapters to master things step by step would then have the possibility of, you know, a glimpse of what, you know, I'm so lucky to be able to talk to you about. There is also a big rider on this. Yoga is described in one text as having eight indivisible limbs. And the first limb is to do with our attitudes to others and the world. And I think you will have heard of at least the first limb, which is ahimsa, or generally described as non-harm. What this actually means is it's a spiritual exercise to edit out from our thoughts, from our hearts, any wish to do any harm to anybody. So it isn't enough to be, for example, vegan or vegetarian, and it may even not be necessary within yoga. What is necessary is to develop this attitude where even when we think people are doing wrong, even when we think people are doing terrible things, not to wish that any harm should come to them, just that they should stop doing these things that are harming others. I know I take as my model, as my example on this, Nelson Mandela. You know, in the 27 years he was in prison, he went from being an angry young man to being a peacemaker who could talk to the people who hated him, but have enough peace in his heart that they did not feel threatened by his presence. And they felt that, they realized that he was someone they could talk to.
Yeah, he is a remarkable person and a great role model. And I do agree with you that, I mean, it depends really, really what, how you define the word vegan, because I know some people will only define it as ahimsa. Like, you have to want no harm to anyone. And yet there are other people who claim to be vegans, but they hate people. So many of us would say they're really not in ahimsa. So ahimsa, you're saying, is the first step? Is that what you said?
It is the first thing that is listed in these eight indivisible limbs of yoga. Now, there are four other elements to this first limb of yoga: truthfulness, honesty, continence as regards physical desires, and not being acquisitive, something of that nature. All of these things are really for our own sake, because, you know, we can't think about having a quiet enough mind to access the deeper levels of meditation if we haven't got these attitudes sorted out.
And I think ahimsa is one that probably the vast majority of the world is right before them. I mean, all of us are challenged by that. And I know that yoga is not specific to any certain religion and has a universality to it, but I would bring in the Christ teaching to love one another. Love one another, I would take as ahimsa. That's just that first thing to get, that we really are connected, and it doesn't matter if the person is doing ill will to you or someone else, that still we are called to to be love. And I think that's why we're here.
In connection with ahimsa, yoga puts this slightly differently. The teaching is that we must aim to develop a proper sense and understanding, another side to things. It could be another option. It could be another person's point of view. The thing is to try in any conflict to avoid taking sides, but to try to see what it is for the two sides. Now, why is some person taking one side? Why is this? And it's only through understanding. So maybe yoga, rather than in terms of love, talks about understanding. Perhaps really the two go together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can see that. And there are just so many things in the world that try to divide us. And really, I think when you're on the spiritual path, what we're called to do is to resist that temptation of division, the division within ourselves and the right and wrong, and you're bad, I'm good. And to like you say, there's an empathy and an understanding of the other side. I watch things a lot about Nazi Germany. It's just something I'm fascinated by because of psychology. And so many people say, oh, I would never do that. I would be this. I would never do that. Well, how does anybody know who they would be in that situation? I do not know myself, even given how much work I've done on myself. I cannot rightly say that I would be that person and not that person in that circumstance. That's one of the reasons I like watching these kinds of documentaries, is because I really start to understand humanity, human nature, and other people better and not judge so much.
I don't know quite what I can say, Carol, about this because I have family history there.
Mm-hmm.
An easy thing, really.
No, it's not.
Yeah.
We can just let that go where it is. Yeah.
Sure.
So back to breath, do you have a sense for why we aren't basically breathing correctly, or the best way for our health, or the best way for our spirit?
Carol, we're still working on all the ways in which people learn to think and feel and about their breath and consequently breathe differently, because we can control the way we breathe and we can misapply that control. So I've given one example where somehow people believe that they need to breathe faster in order to cope, and in that way, what they end up doing is breathing in a very shallow way, and then a way that uses what are called accessory muscles to, here to sort of try to pull air quickly into the upper part of the chest. And that's a very sort of stressy way of breathing that can in fact lead on, unfortunately, to someone experiencing an actual panic attack. So that's just one example. Another example is that people are told to hold their tummies in. And in order to breathe fully, there has to be a little bit of give in the abdominal wall. And we actually have a specialized muscle there. That is now whose job it is to let out a bit when the breath needs to come in, and to pull back in a bit when we need to breathe out. It actually has that role, and you can see that happening in young children. But then there are various reasons people can lose that. Maybe women can lose it because it's now is rather disabled towards the end of a pregnancy, or it can be an emotional thing, because one of the things we teach in yoga is that people hold a lot of emotions in the upper abdominal area. And so for that reason, people tend to hold that area still. And then what happens is that the respiratory diaphragm, which would like to push down, isn't allowed to do that, and instead flares the ribs out, which it can do, and pull the ribs up and flare them out in order to get some breath in. But then that's, you know, another limited and tense way of breathing. Another thing that I and my colleagues see is sometimes when people breathe out, it's as if they're trying to push the breath out, as if they could breathe out downwards. My colleague in New York, Leslie Kamenoff, calls this the poo breath, because and maybe it does arise from too early enthusiastic potty training, that people start to think about their out-breath in this way. And so there is an awful lot of re-education to do, unfortunately, for people's breaths, because it seems, or I'm reliably told, that by the age of 12 or 15, nearly all of us have some idiosyncratic way of breathing that I'm told people, children, even copy from parents and siblings how they should be breathing. And what Mr. Dais Gachal taught us is, yes, we've got all this dysfunction. Let's talk about what's functional and teach that, okay? Rather than trying to get people to unlearn all of this stuff, just start them out in the right direction.
Oh, that's really good. I can definitely identify with some of that, that holding your tummy in. I think that's definitely cultural in the West, particularly among women, but possibly among men as well. Because I've been watching, since I got your book, I've been watching my own breath, and I can see that that's where my psychological resistance is to let that tummy go out. But I can see, like, my little grandbaby, she's lying on her back, and I can just see her little tummy come up, and I can see the whole diaphragm thing working, and I go, what happened to me? What happened to me? And it feels really, I was doing some of the exercises, and it does feel like, you know, wow, you know, I these are muscles I haven't used so much. It seems like there's a lot of conditioning to overcome. But I like the idea of just starting with what works and not worry about really so much how I got there and what's wrong. But what I can do going forward. And I think that's a really good lesson for almost everything on the spiritual path, because a lot of people get stuck in, why am I here? And what did I do to get myself here? And what's wrong with me? And it's like, let's just start with what can we affirm that is good about us, and that we the tools that we have that we can build on so that we can become our better selves. So I really like that emphasis.
That's great.
But, you know, health-wise too, though, people who have significant health problems, would you attribute some of these health problems to the breath?
Well, in 1988, I heard an interview on the BBC with a doctor in Cambridge, UK, and his colleagues were referring patients to him with all sorts of baffling symptoms, because he'd found that many of these patients, he could relieve their symptoms by teaching them how to breathe. Now, there was no traceable other medical reason for the symptoms that they were experiencing. It's just that their breathing was so far out of kilter. And it is recognized within our NHS that between 6 and 12% of the UK population is breathing in a way that's sufficiently dysfunctional to register in a medical context. But other people who are working in the field of remedial breathing and have more experience than I do, wider experience, they think the figure is much higher.
I've never been to any medical professional that has ever asked me about my breathing. No one has ever said, how are you breathing? It's not a question. It's not even, I don't even know if it's an awareness in the medical field. And so my mind is going in two different directions. One is, wouldn't it be great if this became part of diagnosing a person to look at, you know, how are, not only is what's going on in your life and who are you as a person and what are your challenges, but also how are you breathing? And then the other thought that I have as we're talking about how wouldn't it be great if part of preschool and kindergarten and first grade and the whole education system be taking time out to breathe and let's check our breathing. And, you know, that should be, that just seems naturally would be part of how do we support our children as they grow?
Well, the thing is, Carol, that I don't know if you've seen James Nestor's book, which is just entitled Breathe, a New York Times journalist, I believe. And the thing is that the connection between breathing and health and teaching remedial breathing has been through so many fits and starts. Now, someone like Dr. Claude Lum, whom I've just mentioned, these people come along and or Professor Constantine Buteyko, these doctors and other professionals, osteopaths, have this realization about the breath. And they, as individuals, you know, work on it with their patients and clients throughout their careers. But they retire or otherwise lost to us. And somehow these things don't, this never actually becomes a sustained movement of remedial breathing. And so that's what I would like to see at least beginning to happen in my lifetime.
So do you have people, are you a therapist that helps people with their breath? Do they come to you and say, I seek remedial breathing?
Most people don't come to me specifically for that, because for that they'd have to start with the awareness. It's more the other way around. Someone, as I said, might come to me for the pain or anxiety, or simply wanting to deepen their yoga practice. And then, you know, when the time is right, you know, I can see ways for them to start working with the breath. But no, at the moment, maybe this would change. I haven't got people coming to me already coming in with that awareness of their own dysfunctional breathing. Maybe as a result of my book, that will slowly start to happen.
So if somebody has a chronic condition or something that they haven't been able to heal themselves of, or they're just really kind of either emotional, it sounds like depression, those kinds of things, as well as physical, that the breath can support that healing or remedial breathing?
I think it can. But the thing is, Carol, as I'm sure you know, there are so many options out there for care seekers. Now, looking around for various ways for help with whatever problems they're experiencing, that yoga and yoga therapy, there's just one small voice amid a crowd. But we're here.
I could see it becoming a part of like holistic medicine or functional medicine. The doctors who are more interested in the wholeness of a person, not just their symptoms.
I think so. There are also other things, like we have to, even within the yoga world, we have to clear away some misconceptions about working the breath, which I often come across. Yes, the important thing is to keep going.
Yeah, yeah. And see, lots of opportunity. That's the thing about living in this world. You can always say there's lots of potential for everything being better. Why get down when there's so much potential? I want to kind of wrap this up a little bit and give you the chance to share anything that you might not have shared, that I might not have asked you about, that you think is an important message for people about healing, about the breath, about remedial breath, about yoga, whatever it is.
Well, the simple thing is to learn to breathe out from your tummy through your nose. That's really the first thing. And then you end up breathing out more fully, you end up breathing out more slowly. And now that is the start to better, more relaxed breathing. Breathe out from your tummy through your nose. If you don't know how to do this, then my book explains it as best I can and gives you the exercise I've found that will work, that has worked for so many people.
Yeah, it's something to really be conscious of. And I know you talk a lot in the early parts of your book about not breathing out of your mouth. And so what do you do if your nose is all clogged up? I've got to ask that question because I do have that problem from time to time.
I give people the option initially of breathing out through pursed lips, which I learned to teach and then discovered that this is as well actually advice of people with damaged lungs to retain the air in their lungs for longer and get more oxygen out of it. So I thought, this can't be bad. If you start to breathe, if you can just start to breathe more slowly, if you can think about maybe there's enough scope within your nose as it is at the moment to breathe out slowly through your nose as an exercise and just as something you can keep up for a short time. Other teachers have tried things like, get people to breathe out, hold the nose, and then see if the nose would just open when you really need to breathe in. There are a whole lot of things, exercises in which you keep putting the head below the heart, lifting up again, put the head back below the heart, and so on. What you're doing is you're oscillating the blood pressure in the nose and sinuses. And finally, there's humming, where blockage of the nose is caused by long-term sinusitis. Humming. Make it a habit to hum, or at least try to hum it as you go about your daily work. Trouble is, if you're working in an office, it might annoy people. But that has been proven to gradually release congestion in the nose. Now, there's no one answer for everybody. It's not a simple thing, but there are possibilities to try.
Yes. And I think that breathing deep into the belly and holding it and then releasing and breathing through the nose, whenever I help people with trying to start a new habit, I invite them to set an alarm on your phone, once an hour or three times a day or something to just remind you. So the little alarm goes off and it's like, oh, okay, how am I breathing? And okay, I'm gonna take five of these, good kind of belly breaths and then go about your day and then they'll let the alarm go off again and set you back. And, oh, okay, I think now I've got to do it again.
Actually, I think that's a very good and very simple and accessible suggestion, Carol. Little and often is the way.
Well, Michael, thank you so much for joining me. I know it's evening time where you are, and I really appreciate you taking the time. And your book is full of diagrams and instructions and a process, and you do encourage people to take a long time with the process. So it's not a book that you're going to get and read through it and be done with it if you're actually going to do the work. If you're actually going to do the work, it's going to take you a while to get through this book because you really want people to build on developing new breathing habits, and you give people ways to do that.
Just only 10 minutes a day. Keep it up.
Yeah, that's great. Okay. Well, thank you for sharing your knowledge, your book, and your experience with yoga. And thank you, listeners. I hope everybody takes something from this and that we can all start breathing in the ways that our human body are designed to breathe and just have a much more fulfilling spiritual and pain-free life. And that's kind of how I see it all. So I appreciate your coming on. Appreciate everyone who's listening. And join me next week. And I now close the Spiritual Forum. Thanks for listening. If you like this podcast, you can let me know by leaving a positive rating and review on your favorite podcast app, or make a tax-deductible donation at thespiritualforum.org. The Spiritual Forum is a podcast, prayer, and retreat ministry affiliated with Unity Worldwide Ministries. Thank you again for being a part of the Spiritual Forum community. And remember, you are an amazing, divine, and powerful being.